the feeling that the name sort of conjured when saying it was the biggest factor for me, and that's why we settled on it, honestly. I was just looking for it to be not too uppity, not too pretentious. I wanted it to be warm, inviting, and relatable.
I think that's what we craved when we came here, and we wanted to give that experience to other people that might not, you know, that might not know about loose leaf tea or preparing it, or have ever really thought about trying tea.
Coffee is, when done properly, is more than just a means to an end, and that end being caffeination. Mm-hmm. You know, coffee is a world or a universe or a journey or whatever trite metaphor you want to insert there within itself. Good coffee should take you somewhere. It should tell a story.
This is Something from Nothing, a podcast about the creative process and the individuals involved. I'm Justin Lewis. Today, the story of Piper's Tea and Coffee. With me to tell the story is Peter Barnett, his wife Amber, and Bobby Dow. It's easy to differentiate the three voices in this episode. Peter has the British accent, Amber is the female voice, and Bobby, the American male voice. Simple. FYI, these interviews were all done separately. Piper's is a tea and coffee shop tucked inside a historic former Coca-Cola bottling plant. It's just a few years old. But the idea, of course, is much older. Peter and Amber decided they wanted to own a shop sitting together in a bookstore while living in Colorado. For this couple, bookstores are serendipitous and important, as will be seen later in the show. But plenty happened before the bean of an idea grew, or leaf sprouted, in that bookshop. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. First things first, what about that English accent? Peter is from England, and although you can't really tell from listening to her, Amber kind of is too. Here's what I mean by kind of. Her parents brought her to England when she was 13 years old, and that is what she considered home before settling in Kentucky. I asked Amber why she didn't have a British accent.
I used to. When we first moved back, about, gosh, I think it's been 7 years we've been in back in the States, and I kind of had what people like to call mid-Atlantic, so it wasn't fully British, but it wasn't fully American. So I would come, and I started a few jobs, and every job, everyone was like, oh, I could pick it up. Yeah, I could just hear. I would use, like, words or how I sounded my ERs, and I've lost it now. Sometimes I catch myself being very Southern, which is okay. It's my roots. I like it. But, yeah, I've lost it now.
So how did Amber get her British husband back to her homeland?
Well, honestly, it didn't take much twisting of the arm. We got married in, October, and by the following May, we were over here. We were just going to come for a visit, but we kind of had the intention of staying, and it was just a new opportunity. It was fun. We're kind of adventurers.
Their adventure took them from a short time in Colorado to here in Kentucky, and Mayfield was the first stop. Amber's great-grandmother was in need of highly focused care. During this time, Peter worked at a coffee shop in Paducah. He proved to himself and the corporate higher-ups that he had what it took to run a successful coffee shop.
At the time, I wanted to go and get a job and was offered a position at a coffee shop that was actually a corporate coffee shop. The location-specific was given about 9 months left before they were going to close it. And the GM at the time told me this. And after 6 months of me, they made me manager within 2 months, and then after 6 months they actually decided not to close it, as it seemed to have been doing, you know, the numbers seemed to be increasing. Over the next 18 months, I actually, with developing a better team that worked there, and a lot of hard work, we actually managed to increase the sales from this particular location to one of the top 10 in their entire corporate structure.
But it takes more than good management and hard work. Passion is a key ingredient.
once one has had any experience as a barista, it's almost an addictive kind of vocation. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to explain to people who haven't been a barista, but it's the very nature of the work. It's like a very sobering barman. You know, you get to chat to a lot of people on a daily basis. You get to create pretty fun drinks to make. Mm-hmm. And although challenging, it is a very rewarding vocation. And once you've experienced it and if you enjoy it, I think it's very difficult to step away from it. And I think I've heard that over and over again from most people. And some people go away and do other things for a while, but I think once you've got the bug, it's very difficult to drop it.
So while Peter is growing this passion as a barista, Amber's great-grandmother is continuing to decline in health. Peter shared a touching story about how the circle of life played out with his first daughter.
While we were living there, we conceived our first child, and it was one of those more poignant moments in life where Amber, who spent most of the time looking after her great-grandmother, who she'd known throughout her younger life and had very fond memories of that particular house and visiting for the holidays and so forth, and she had always said to her grandmother, you know, please stay alive so you can see your first great-great-grandchild. And just before Amber went into labor, the couple of the weeks before, the rest of the family had decided that she would be better off moving to, you know, a home with full-time professional care. And Amber then gave birth. We named one of Millie's middle names is Inez, which is after her great-grandmother. And we went, after Amber had recovered from the birth, we went to have that classic sort of photo taken with the five generations all in one photo. Mm. And it was really sweet that Amber's great-grandmother got to hold Millie. Mm-hmm. She held her, we took the photos, and that night she died.
It's like, I don't know, it was a very serendipitous sort of like fate sort of moment.
They stayed in Mayfield, and while Peter worked as a barista for a corporate shop, the couple dreamed of opening their own.
And really just, you know, started really thinking about, okay, how are we going to do this? And we had originally thought about doing it in Mayfield.
And it was about that time that I bumped into a gentleman called Mr. Edward Musselman at another bookstore. And there we connected while discussing concrete countertops. And I asked him why he was talking about concrete countertops, and he informed me that he had just purchased a building in Paducah and was hopefully doing up and was trying to attract some businesses to come into it. I asked him which one it was, and he said it's the old Coca-Cola plant, which, if you've ever been to Paducah, it's a very difficult landmark building to miss. So I immediately knew which one he was talking about, and at that point asked him whether he would be interested in, you know, having a tea and coffee shop. And he said it was one of his, you know, primary goals to get a, you know, upscale tea and coffee shop, or at least a coffee shop.
Peter said it was very early on when they initiated the relationship with Ed Musselman. He and Amber hadn't even really started looking for locations. Without much effort, they had stumbled upon an opportunity to be part of an iconic piece of architecture. In Peter's eyes, it added a sense of gravitas. As far as he was concerned, there was no sense in looking further. So this landmark may be one that elevates the sense of place now, but it had been abandoned for 10 years, previously was a bottling plant, and had originally been built in the late 1930s. There was work to be done in order to open a 21st century coffee shop, but they made it happen. When Peter met Ed,
he was halfway through, you know, really putting the systems in place to bring it back to a level that was even, you know, appropriate for businesses to be in there, which was, I think, a very difficult job for him. Mm-hmm. With the infrastructure that was needed in terms of the heating and cooling and the sprinkler system, and the historical nature of the building and what he had to do in terms of like formatting the building that way. And then for us, it was very much a sympathetic development. Everything from sourcing like the subway tiles that match the dimensions from the existing ceramic bricks that already existed in the building, to using metals that already appear throughout the building itself. There is a big copper dome roof on the top. There is a lot of stainless steel that's used in the awning outside the front with those great, impressive front doors. We definitely wanted to incorporate those pieces into the design of what we were doing. Mm-hmm. A lot of the wood was either sourced from the building or locally that we used for all of the worktops and the tabletops that we have in the store. And so I think when you approach a building of such magnitude like this, you have to then think about a sympathetic development of that. It was a rough space that we had to deal with.
Even with the disrepair it was currently in, Peter found it to be worth it. I mean, don't get it twisted. It wasn't a junk house they were inhabiting. Peter was sure to point this out.
The Cope building itself still had quite a level of grandeur. The very unique terrazzo floor and staircase in the rotunda is very unique. And throughout the test of time, very much kept that initial feeling that I think that Luther Carson, who originally built the Cope plant, had wanted from the very start.
But even with his vision of what Piper's could be aesthetically, Peter said he wasn't able to fully realize just how visually appealing a visit could be from a customer until they were later on in the process and he himself experienced coming through those
large, heavy stainless steel doors in the front, coming up against that gorgeous rotunda with that circular staircase.
And to the right is the shop, inside an old money deposit area. That's where they currently sell coffee and tea. Besides the actual physical location transformation, which took about a year to complete from the time of that fateful bookstore meeting, other things were needed, namely a staff. And Peter knew exactly the person he wanted to start with.
My go-to was always a very good friend of mine, Bobby Dowell, who is now Colonel Bobby Dowell.
This wouldn't be the first time Peter recruited Bobby. The Colonel was actually recruited into the coffee-serving business by Peter while he was managing the other place.
He, at the time, was playing a lot more music and was floating around, and I think I managed to speak to him at that crucial moment in life where he was transitioning away from the music and looking more at getting a career. And I approached him and basically asked whether he was into coffee, at which point he shrugged his shoulders and said he certainly enjoyed a cup now and again. At that point I said, well, you know, you look like a barista and I think that we should get the collar to match the cuffs, as it were. So
I was profiled and extremely triggered because of it.
This is Colonel Bobby Dow. He gave his recollection of the recruitment.
Peter and I were working at this bookstore that also had a cafe attached to it. You know, one day he came up to me while we were slacking, and he was like, you know what, man, I'm not even going to attempt an English accent because I'll just embarrass myself. It'll sound South African, and how dare I? He came up to me, and, you know, for those of you listening that do not know me, I have a lot of tattoos, and I've got a big beard, and apparently those are things that you have when you are a barista. And he said that, you know, hey, you look like a barista. You should make coffee. He was right.
You know,
he was right. Yeah.
It worked out.
Don't tell him I said that, but he was right.
From the get-go, Bobby's shown an enormous amount of potential. And throughout the last 5 years of development, he has continued to grow and grow with us. He now holds the position as head roaster here at Piper's Lab, where we do all of the coffee roasting, the tea blending. He is on our tasting team. And he still likes, from a personal level, to hold a couple of hours up at the cafe, simply because he just enjoys it so much. But his real talent, I think, has been fostered to a level where he has become, by some regard, actually quite a talented roaster. And this, in a roaster's life, is a very early stage, and he has already excelled at this stage, so I have high hopes for him for the future. It should be an interesting one to follow.
Indeed. In fact, I literally followed Bobby back to the Piper's lab, with his knowledge, just to be clear, and he showed me a little bit of the roasting process. The Piper's lab is in the bowels of the coke plant. Walking away from the businesses on the edges and into the area where the lab is located kind of made me feel like I was getting a special treat. I guess it kind of was. On the walk back there, there's junk all around. Items with rusted metal. Any bit of sound is echoey. It really was pretty much what you would expect in the middle of an old building. Then you see the lab. The door has a window which is roughly half the size, with window decal lettering, Piper's Lab. Underneath it, head roaster, Bobby Dow. It's a room roughly the size as a big classroom in school, maybe a little smaller. When we went inside, I immediately noticed a completely different feel than just outside the door. The lab is orderly, clean, and very well lit. The roaster is in the back, it's large. Well, the one I first noticed. One is about 5 feet tall, and too large to wrap my arms around. At least I think so. I didn't try. The other, the one hooked up to the computer, is about the size of 2 toasters put together. This one is known as a sample roaster, or sampler. Basically, you can make sure it tastes okay without using a huge batch. Bobby and I went over to the roasting area, the back right corner, and he talked to me about the process.
So you want to make sure that you've had the machine on for a while, just to make sure that you've cultivated enough heat within the machine to propel you to the end of your roast properly. Next step is to drop them, you know, so you want to get the beans in there and get them rotating. And then you start measuring, you know, then you start making sure that, you know, you've hit your correct times and your correct temperatures to make sure that your turning point, which the turning point is the moment that the drum and the beans have reached equilibrium, that they're that same temperature. So then you start to see a rise in temperature. Then you've entered what's called the drying phase. And right there, what's happening is you're doing exactly that. You're drying out all the moisture from the beans themselves to then propel you into the Maillard phase, which is where you're cultivating a lot of acids. You know, you're putting in good acids and you're getting rid of the bad ones. You know, I won't bore you guys with all the details of the different types of acids, but believe it or not, there are several. Then once you pass through the Maillard phase, you get into what's called first crack and then into the development phase where you're caramelizing sugars and really getting those like sweet flavors that you love out of coffee, you know, or that you should be loving out of coffee. If you're not getting coffee that has any sweetness to it, then I would say maybe try a different brand of coffee. And then, you know, that's really where the magic happens.
But not every roast is magical. Bobby mentioned a time when things didn't go as planned.
You know, I thought I'd worked really hard on, they were some Mexican Chiapas beans, so they were fairly low grown. And I thought I had worked out a pretty decent roast on them and was going into a production roast. And it just kind of, you know, got off the rails and it got a little hotter than I had anticipated. And I was like, well, crap. But, you know, the rule of thumb is, even if you mess it up, keep them, put them off to the side, and then cup them, taste them. You know, if it tastes good, then it's good. You know, I mean, your palate's not going to lead you astray. So I left them to the side, let them off gas for a couple days, and then cupped them, and was like, oh, wow, this is better than what I was doing. You know, thank you, mistakes. This is wonderful. So, yeah, and then that became the new profile for those beans. Not all mistakes are bad.
Okay, maybe that is a bad example of a roast not being magical. In addition to roasting, this is where the tea is blended. They have like 30 white industrial strength boxes, about twice the size as a sneaker's shoebox. They're lined across the wall on shelves. There's a spacious countertop underneath, but it isn't Bobby who is the primary blender.
Amber is really the one to...
She does most of that?
She's the... I would say... the main creative force behind a lot of the teas.
Okay.
She is amazingly talented when it comes to that skill set.
Mm-hmm.
Really, because like the level, you have to have an amazing ability to smell to be able to blend tea properly, because there's so much subtlety and nuance.
Tea was actually our first love. I think being in England, tea is kind of the main drink consumed. And so I got a love for it. And you break 2-3 times a day for a cup of tea. And it's just, you know, when you go to someone's house, hey, do you want a cup of tea? It's just part of the whole culture. And so when we came back here, it's obviously quite difficult, especially in areas, in Western Kentucky, to find, really fine teas. And we, loose leaf tea is really the kind of the higher quality, just ingredients wise and taste wise as well. And so when we couldn't find any, we were like, right, well, let's just see what we can find. Let's see what we can source. Let's see what we can create. Let's see if this is something that's kind of doable. And so our first one that we created was our Earl Grey, because that's just, it's kind of, it's not the standard, but it's very much the, taste of what everyday tea in England is like. But we thought we want to elevate it. We want to make it like the best we can make it. And so we got really high quality black tea from China, and like the silver needle, which is like the white tip of the actual tea bush. That's very just like fine. And you can drink that on its own, but it's a pricey per cup. It's pretty pricey for that. And so just mixing just a light amount of that in it and some, bergamot, and we tasted and it was like, wow, like this was fun and this tastes good. And so over time it was kind of a passion project. And so we did a few, and people would come over to the house and they'd be like, oh, would you guys like a cup of tea? Mm-hmm. And so we just started serving it to friends and everyone was like, oh, this is pretty good.
Then the year they really broke out was when they did the Amour blend. This was about 1 year before they opened the shop. For those who do not speak French, Amour is love. Also, there is a decent chance I'm not pronouncing it correctly. My high school French is a little rusty. Anyways, this love blend was released fittingly for Valentine's Day.
So we used honeysuckle flowers, and we did a rooibos base, which is caffeine-free. Because a lot of people, with teas, it's kind of popular to do like a caffeine-free version. And it kind of lends itself more to like a florally and kind of taste. So we added honeysuckle and cocoa nibs and rose petals. And it was kind of like, all the typical things you would maybe gift to the person you love on Valentine's Day. And we made this tea out of it. And we ended up selling, for not having a storefront or even a website at that point. We sold I think quite a few pots of it. We just kind of blended it up and people really enjoyed it. So
they kept going and started adding different types.
The blacks, the whites, the greens, the reds. I mean, the matcha comes along. And matcha it's kind of funny because it's been around for thousands of years, in Japan. Like, the Japanese probably look at us Americans and think, we've been doing this for years. that's what I love about America, though, because you can take something that's been around for a long time and still take it and reinvent it.
Like maybe a former Coca-Cola bottling plant? Anyways, back to blending.
We started with the basics, a chai, Moroccan mint, the jasmine, our herbal. So we kind of started what I don't call them basic as in because they're basic teas, but just that's like a great foundation to start upon. And they're great ones to kind of make your own. So our chai, it's funny, it's kind of gone through two reinventions over the past 4 years. And we've just, through either tasting other ones or actually through traveling and things like that, we thought, let's add a little bit more of this. Let's add this. Maybe take this out and change it up. So we're always wanting to be open to bettering what we're providing. Some of them we've gotten to the point where they're great and we love them and our customers love them, which is great. And then other ones we kind of experiment with, but I'm trying to think my mom is originally, she was born in Morocco. And so the Moroccan mint kind of has a very like just a very special place because, you know, she would serve it and be served it when she was younger, you know, from the beautiful Moroccan teapots, and they put, like, you know, the sugar cubes in it. And then it's like, because they joke in Morocco, you either serve it with sugar or a lot of sugar. Those are the two options.
As a southerner, that sounds like somewhere else I know. An important part of tea blending is a sense of smell. Amber's sense of smell is something she once wanted to put to use in other ways. The former European had at one point explored the possibility of smelling perfumes in Paris before they were released. She went to check it out at one of the factories and everything. Turns out they weren't hiring at the time. C'est la vie. Although that didn't end up working out, she now is able to use that skill in the blending process.
When it comes to making new teas, yeah, it's kind of like, okay, which ones, you know, what do we know from what we've already done that really work together well? What, like, two ingredients? And, you know, I'll get them down. And it's, you know, it's a case of the process is, like, very much smell orientated as well as taste. But really, you're working off of your knowledge of what maybe each ingredient tastes like, but then you're also like, okay, we got to smell them together and then taste test them together. Right. And so it's kind of like, you know, what we've done most of the time, we'll individually try each herb, like, and each see person. What it actually tastes like, just brewed up on its own. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be like, okay, well, let's try these two together and these three. And then that's like with the orchard, it's a case, you know, we taste test it quite a lot just to kind of see what balance is, like, do we need more of this or less of this, and things like that. And just getting that balance right.
Talking with all three of them, it should be noted, Peter, Amber, and Bobby reference the importance and value of all the baristas that contribute or have contributed to Piper's. Amber gave the analogy of birthing the shop, but it is the baristas who are the major contributors to keeping it going. Amber or Peter, maybe both, told me customer service was actually in the business plan. This has been important to them since day one. Speaking of day one, I asked each of them to describe what they remember from a few years ago.
Opening day was an interesting one. There was actually four of us. My wife, obviously Bobby, and Grace included on that day. And it was a real blur for me, that whole sort of period of time. You can ask Amber or Bobby on that one.
Day one was crazy, man. Like, we thought we had an idea of what a rush, like, actually is behind a bar, with working where we worked previously and the holiday season and all that stuff. But when we opened the doors, it was a whole new level. People were wrapping around the rotunda. I mean, it was wild, but it was exhilarating.
Bobby said he and Peter didn't leave the espresso machine for 6 hours. For the uninformed, that's where the lattes are made. For the even less informed, that's where the fancy coffees are made. Bobby went on to say it was just a constant flow of business, and he loved it.
I was slotted for a 4 hour kind of shift. And because I'm not the coffee preparer, I was the one put on the cash register. So for 4 hours, I was talking and smiling and taking orders one after one after one. It never stopped. And it was just, I think even talking about it with you now, it's very surreal to even kind of remember it. But if I close my eyes, I can just visualize it. All the people coming through, we had music playing in the rotunda, which was like a really big thing. You know, obviously with Mellow Mushroom open now, we don't do it as much, but like that was a really big thing, the music and the rotunda. It's got such a beautiful acoustic sound. Did I say that right? I'm sorry.
That's my American English,
there you go. And so, you know, we had just so much support. We had family come out. We had friends come out. We had just people so energized by the fact that we had done this as well, which then further energized us. And it was just, the energy was great. The vibes were great. And so, yeah, it's just, you know, I got done and my like mouth was hurting because I was just like pretty much smiling and talking to people the whole time. And it was kind of like a huge like adrenaline rush, you know. So after I got done, I was like, okay, gotta calm down, you know, wait to see how the rest of the day went, you know, with Peter being there. But it was great.
In Amber's words, it was a dream come true. I wasn't there day one, but full disclosure, I've been there many days since. And to close the episode, here's the proof.
So your current usual is a 6-ounce latte. You usually get that in the morning before work. And your favorite drink, I would probably say, is a mint chocolate matcha.
Nailed it on that day. But since then, my regular has changed. And it had a lot to do with this following discussion I had with Amber.
Yeah, I actually don't even hardly drink coffee anymore. I've kind of substituted it for the matcha. Just gives a better caffeine boost, more consistent caffeine levels, and really actually helps with like focus and
really
enjoy it.
So
yeah, it's really good for you actually.
Compare a matcha and a latte for the morning time, like you're like, all right, I'm about to get my day started.
Right, it's a very similar caffeine quantity,
okay.
But the way the caffeine molecules are released are very different. So with coffee, you actually get like kind of a spike of energy, mm-hmm. and then you usually are going to experience like a crash. Whereas matcha has a component in it that like slowly releases the caffeine energy over like a 3-hour period of time. So you get a much more kind of, not zen-like, but almost like zen-like, very focused sort of few-hour period with it.
Extended release.
Yeah, and you don't have the crash of when the caffeine kind of completes its process through your body. So, yeah, it's pretty good for you.
Piper's has settled in as a recognized establishment in Paducah, especially in the Midtown area. It's no longer as much a place to try out. It's built regulars. And is a place to hang out. You can learn more about Piper's on social media. They're on Facebook and Instagram at Cup of Piper's. They have a ton of pictures displaying their aesthetically pleasing drinks. It's worth checking out. I also really recommend those drinks. Something from Nothing is also on social media, and episodes from all 4 seasons can be found on WKMS.org. This episode was edited by Taylor Inman and produced by me, your host, Justin Lewis.